From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. The Canadian comedy troupe Second City and its television show SCTV was an often-tapped resource from which much great American comedy emerged, including many cast members of Saturday Night Live. On today's Fresh Air, we meet some of the actors who made up the cast of SCTV. From the Great White North, Dave Thomas. Catherine O'Hara, who created the not-quite-famous-enough-to-be-washed-up entertainer, Lola Heatherton. Then Eugene Levy reminisces about his wonderfully obnoxious showbiz character, Bobby Bittman. And Martin Short tells us about a childhood full of showbiz dreams. Second City TV, coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Ukraine's two presidential rivals failed to reach agreement today in a meeting to seek a way out of the country's election deadlock. The government says Prime Minister Viktor Yanukovych won, but international observers say there was widespread vote fraud. Opposition leader Viktor Yushchenko has called for a new election, but NPR's Lawrence Sheets says the opposition might not trust the current government to conduct it fairly.
And the people in power, they will say, have too much to lose. They don't want to lose at the ballot box. They cannot lose face by losing at the ballot box. And, of course, the pre-election campaign that ran up to this election was horribly dirty. We had the challenger, Viktor Yushchenko, whose face is still green and very sort of pockmarked because he said that the Ukrainian security services had tried to poison him.
NPR's Lawrence Sheets in Kyiv, Ukraine. Iran has withdrawn its effort to seek exemptions in a deal to suspend its nuclear enrichment activities. The announcement came today during talks at the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna. In the original deal, negotiated with France, Germany, and Britain, Iran had said it would suspend all its efforts to enrich uranium. Yesterday, Iran's delegates stirred up a storm of protest when they tried to change that to allow Iran to continue to enrich some uranium for use in nuclear power production. The U.S. is charged that Iran's program is intended to produce nuclear weapons. President Bush said today that he welcomes the new agreement as long as it's verifiable. Jailed Palestinian leader Marwan Barghouti has taken himself out of the running to replace Yasser Arafat as head of the Palestinian Authority. Barghouti agreed to support the candidacy of interim leader Mahmoud Abbas after holding talks in his prison cell with Palestinian officials. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from Jerusalem.
Barghouti's decision not to seek the presidency of the Palestinian Authority gives a shot in the arm to the campaign of Mahmoud Abbas. The move appears intended to avert a split in the ruling Fatah movement ahead of the January 9th vote. Fatah's old guard leaders had feared that Barghouti's relative youth and popularity among the new guard in Fatah could carry him to victory were he to have run as an independent. Fatah, the largest and most powerful political faction, wrapped up its endorsement Thursday, throwing support behind the 69-year-old Abbas. While Barghouti appealed for unity, there were many young Palestinians disappointed by his removal from the race, and they said uncertain about how they would vote in the first Palestinian election in 8 years. Julie McCarthy, NPR News, Jerusalem.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 2 points to close at 10,522 in light trading. The Dow was up 65 points for the week. The Nasdaq Composite Index lost a fraction to close at 2102. This is NPR News. The World Trade Organization imposed penalties on some U.S. exports today as punishment for U.S. legislation designed to protect American steelmakers. The penalties affect a wide range of U.S. exports, ranging from apples to textiles. Work crews have opened one lane in each direction on Interstate 70 in Colorado. The busy highway was shut down yesterday after a massive rock slide. Andre Lee reports from member station KAJX.
Early yesterday morning, 30 to 40 boulders slid down a mountain face near Glenwood Canyon onto about 100 feet of I-70, punching holes in bridges and embedding themselves up to 8 feet into the roadway. A geologist from the Colorado Department of Transportation has investigated the site and decided there is still some rock on the slope that needs to come down. Crews are blasting and scaling the mountain before any more rock tumbles down. Department spokeswoman Stacy Stegman.
Even a 12-inch rock coming from 15 feet above the highway can do some serious damage and cause tragic circumstances. And so even just the smallest rock that we're finding that's loose, we're trying to get down right now.
For NPR News, I'm Andre Lee in Aspen.
U.S. retailers are projecting strong growth in business over the holiday season. The National Retail Federation says it expects sales to grow by 4.5% over November and December. A strong holiday season is crucial to many merchants because the organization says holiday sales account for nearly one quarter of retail selling for the entire year. A survey that was conducted for the Federation estimates that 130 million people will go shopping this weekend. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
The NPR Shop offers a variety of games and puzzles selected with public radio listeners in mind. These and other gift suggestions are at npr.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Guy Caballero, owner and president of the SCTV Network. Well, tonight's pledge night here at SCTV, and we're hoping you'll pledge lots of money to our network. Now, some of you at home might be saying to yourselves, but I thought SCTV was a commercial network. Well, it is. But just because it's commercial doesn't mean we're making money. Now, you people out there, I'll be honest with you. If you want to see good programming, you're just going to have to kick in and help pay for it. You know, these programs we watch here aren't cheap, believe me. So why don't you just do your duty and pledge money? Lots of money. You'll help keep SCTV in the black, and you'll continue to enjoy fine shows. Shows like this one coming up.
That's Joe Flaherty as Guy Caballero, owner of a fictional TV station called SCTV. It was a low-rent operation run by a strange woman named Edith Prickly, and offering everything from public service shows like English for Beginners to old-fashioned variety shows starring albino entertainer Jackie Rogers Jr. In reality, SCTV was a brilliant satire concocted by the Toronto branch of the Second City Comedy Improv Troupe. The second DVD set collecting some of the best of SCTV has just been released, preserving and presenting some of the funniest TV satire ever performed. Cast members of SCTV included John Candy, Joe Flaherty, Andrea Martin, Rick Moranis, and four very talented people we'll hear from today: Eugene Levy, Martin Short, Catherine O'Hara, and our first guest, Dave Thomas as the Beaver. That's the way he was identified each week in the SCTV credits. Terry Gross spoke with Dave Thomas in 1990 when he had his own short-lived summer series, The Dave Thomas Comedy Show. Here's a sample in which he explains how he impersonates Bob Hope.
I've noticed some things about Bob, some little idiosyncrasies that perhaps some of you have noticed. Like, when Bob is talking about beautiful and sexy women, his voice goes up very high, like this.
Hey, here's Stevie Nicks with her new hit single, and then joining me later in the show will be Kiki D with the pretty baby herself, Miss Brooke Shields, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah, right here on the show. But when Bobby is referring to important people, his voice drops way down, you know, like this. Now, I did 9 holes with Maggie Thatcher the other day, and I'll tell you, the Iron Lady can really smack a ball, you know what I mean? Yeah, and we were out there with Malcolm Forbes and General Westmoreland, and then Gerald Ford joined us on the back nine. You know, and then we went to the lounge, and Kiki D was in there, and we had a drink with her.
My favorite characterization of yours is Bob Hope.
And yeah.
I was wondering how you first did him.
Well, I'll tell you, what happened there was we were doing a thing, Brian Doyle Murray, Bill's brother, and I wrote a thing called the Bob Hope Desert Classic, which kind of combined two things that were real tough, close to Bob at that time, and that was golf and war. So I really didn't know how to do them. I'd never done them before. I'd done kind of just the high, whiny voice of Bob Hope here in... We're in Phnom Penh, 50 miles north of the DMZ, you know. So I was working on it, but I hadn't really sort of refined it. And then when we got into makeup and they put this, this was pre-prosthetics, and they put a wax nose on me. And I looked in the mirror and I said, gee, I still don't look like him. And they slicked my hair back and grayed it a little. And then Beverly Sheckman, who was the makeup designer, said, well, why don't you stick your jaw out, you know, because his jaw is bigger than yours. So as soon as I stuck my jaw out, I had kind of a little cup that I could speak into in the front here. And that, for all you lame impersonators out there that are trying to do them, that's the secret to how to do them. And the minute someone else gets them down, then I'll stop doing them, too. So,
on SCTV, you used to do Bob Hope to Rick Moranis' Woody Allen.
Yep.
Who came up with the idea to put the two characters together?
Well, Rick could do Woody, and I had done Bob. So, you know, we were always fooling around in the offices and kind of packaging unlikely combinations of people that would be put together, you know. And so we barked this thing into one of those little micro cassette recorders one day, and it came out quite funny, the Play It Again Bob thing that we ended up doing with Woody and Bob together. So we decided to write it up as a sketch from the notes, and we changed very little, really, from what we improvised. And we shortened it, of course, but we changed very little of the structure of the piece. And we just thought that Woody had, especially in his earlier comedy, not like Interiors and darker stuff like that they did later, but in his earlier comedies, he borrowed a lot from Bob Hope. He played the coward character and was always kind of like backing out a door with gorillas, you know, like he'd take the money and run. Yeah, you guys, well, you guys and Bob Hope was like, yeah, listen, hey, but I'm not the guy. So that sort of borrowing the coward character, and he added the sort of neurosis touch. So we played with that in the piece, you know, that Bob would be talking to Woody about doing something together, but Bob wouldn't want to get into all that New York neurosis stuff that Woody, you know, was into, that kind of stuff.
I know what you're thinking, that this whole thing was a crazy idea from the beginning. There was such an irreconcilable conflict of styles that there'd be no hope for compromise, that ultimately one of us would have to give in or the whole thing would fall through. Who knows? Maybe Freud was right, that the whole story is written beforehand and that all you can do is play it out and hope you get a good part.
Hi, ladies and gentlemen. Does this guy still drive me nuts with his crazy introspection? Come on, Woody, we got a plane to catch. Take it easy, ladies and gentlemen. That topical stuff we added to your monologue is gonna slay them.
Geez, I don't know. It's been so long since I worked live. You think they'll like me?
Are you kidding? Those guys have been sitting on aircraft carriers in the Persian Gulf for a year. They're ready for anything.
So I hope they have Gravol at the duty-free shop. I get seasick really easily.
Stop whining, will you? Stick with me, pal, and the only thing that'll make you sick is standing on solid ground.
Did you ever do jokes yourself?
When?
You know, stand-up jokes, yeah.
When I was a kid, you mean, or stand-up comedy?
Stand-up comedy.
No, I just started doing this. Ironically, I decided to wait till I was 40 to try stand-up. You know, all the other guys that are down there at these clubs are 20 years old, and so I kind of creak in and try my jokes out. And strangely enough, the way it's worked out is that I've been using The Tonight Show to work out my comedy act for the improv, because I'm doing a show that I'm doing a piece at the improv for. Instead of the other way around, you know, using the improv to work out your act for The Tonight Show, I've been testing my material on The Tonight Show for the improv. It's funny if you get it, you know. Anyway.
Oh, jeez. I want to ask you about the McKenzie Brothers, another sketch that originated on SCTV. And this was The Great White North with you and Rick Moranis. What's the story behind how you started doing this parody of Canadians and Canadian TV?
Well, the Canadian show was 2 minutes longer than the American show, and so this is when we were doing the half hour in syndication, and they needed something to fill that difference between the two shows, and they wanted to find something that they could do cheaply as well. So they suggested that we do something Canadian content. Well, we were kind of infuriated by this. That's a kind of a national neurosis in Canada, you know, that they're always talking about their identity and Canadian content and everything, and it's more of a phenomenon, a literary phenomenon, than it is a public phenomenon. But anyway, it's kind of irritating when you're doing a show in Canada with an entire Canadian crew, half the cast is Canadian, most of the writers are Canadian, and then the CBC and your producers turn around and say to you, could you do something Canadian? You know, you morons, this is Canadian already. But they didn't seem to think so. So as a joke, we said to them, well, what do you want us to do? Just put up a map of Canada and dress in ski hats and parkas and, you know, and talk like this, eh? Like, I can't drink beer, like, they said, yeah, that'd be great. And could you put a Mountie in the scene, too, you know? So that's what we did as a sort of a, as a joke at the producer's expense. And, of course, little did we know that it would catch on, you know? And people would come to us and say, thanks for putting us on the map, eh? You know? And it was like, oh, okay, well, you're welcome.
Okay, good day. Welcome to the Great White North. Go. Go again. Beautiful. Okay, good day. Welcome to the Great White North. I'm Bob McKenzie. This is my brother, Doug.
How's it going, eh?
And whoa, did you hear about, well, you can tell.
Okay, you hear about the guy who, like, was opening a beer, eh, and, like, went to drink and then did the stupid thing of looking in the bottle and, whoa, there's a mouse in his bottle, eh?
Real mouse. Well, I guess it was dead, right? Drowned from beer.
Yeah.
And drunk, too.
Like it died too. It had a smile on its face, eh?
It died from drunk driving in the bottle. But you know what the guy got?
Tell him. A whole case of beer.
Right.
So our topic today is how to stuff a mouse into a beer bottle without breaking it.
Bottle.
Its bones.
Right.
So that they'll look at it and give you a case and not think you hosed them by deliberately stuffing one in, eh? It's like shipbuilding in a bottle, okay?
Right. And, like, the thing to remember is, let's say you get a six-pack, right?
Yeah.
Six mice, right?
Six mice.
Okay, you get a case for each beer bottle with a mouse.
All you know is get baby mice and put them in there, feed them for, like, a month, and then Bob's your uncle.
Hundred and...
Good day, eh? We don't have time for you to do your math.
144.
He flunked out of grade 6.
Now, you wrote ad copy for a few years before joining SCTV, right?
Mm-hmm.
So how'd you get back from advertising back into performance?
I became frustrated and bored. I mean, there's only so long you can play second fiddle to a box of soap before you start to go, wait, this can't be all there is. And the guy who hired me was a very funny guy. His name is Harry Yates, and he had worked at Doyle Dane Burnback in New York. And when he hired me, he gave me a book called The Ad Man by Jack Dylan. It's a very morbid and depressing book. And at the end, the hero of the book is left on his front lawn. His wife and kids have left him. He's lying in a pool of his own vomit, and his life is completely destroyed and ruined. And Harry said to me, read this book, and if you still want to be in advertising after reading this book, report Monday at 9 a.m. for work. So I always had that book in the back of my head as you know, what the possibilities were and in their most horrible form. And so then I went down and saw Second City, and I saw, you know, Dan Aykroyd and John Candy and those guys up on stage having a great time. And I started going down there and watching it a lot. And then I heard they were going to open a company in Pasadena, and they were sending three guys down there. They were sending Eugene Levy, Joe Flaherty, and John Candy to Pasadena, and Danny was going to stay, and I loved him and what he did, and so I went and just auditioned, and I auditioned every night for 5 nights. That's what you do. You do the improv sets with them every night for 5 nights. It was a really harrowing experience trying to improvise with Dan Aykroyd and John Candy and Joe Flaherty. I mean, these guys are real pros, but I got in, so... I quit advertising so fast, you know. I mean, I couldn't write my letter of resignation quick enough.
What was one of the first improvs you had to do?
Well, I remember there was a life, this was when I was auditioning, there was a life raft scene, and it was Candy, Flaherty, myself, and Aykroyd on stage, and the deal was we were all stranded in a life raft. There was the usual sort of, like, emergency operation that had to be performed on a seaman, and then the sort of, like, don't drink too much of that salt water. All those gags, you know, from the movie Lifeboat and things like that. We exhausted all those. And then Joe bailed out. Joe, that's it. And I can't take it anymore. And he rolled out of the mime boat and swam off stage and through the curtain and exited. And then one by one, like, then somebody else left. And then, I get the picture. I'm going to be out here alone. So I went third. And they told me afterwards, they said that was a really good sign, you know, that if people start bailing out and you're smart enough to get out first, then you pass the test, you know.
Dave Thomas, speaking with Terry Gross in 1990. He wrote a book on the history of SCTV called SCTV Behind the Scenes. Coming up, Rona Barrett, Meryl Streep, Katharine Hepburn, Dusty Town, and Lola Heatherton. The impersonations and characters created by Katharine O'Hara. That's after a short break. This is Fresh Air. As one of two women in the original company of SCTV, our next guest, Catherine O'Hara, had a lot of work to do each week. From glamorous impersonations of Brooke Shields and Ingrid Bergman, to wacky original characters like really stupid game show performers and increasingly impatient schoolteachers. In film, she's played everything from the mom in Home Alone to the love-struck folk singer in A Mighty Wind. Her other credits include Best in Show, as well as the dramas Wyatt Earp and HBO's 6 Feet Under. John Candy hired Catherine O'Hara in 1973 for Second City in Toronto. At the time, she was working the coat check concession at the Fire Hall, a converted theater space where Second City was performing. She got her big break the next year replacing Gilda Radner when Gilda left Second City to join the National Lampoon cast in New York. Terry spoke with Catherine O'Hara in 1992.
So you got hired as an understudy for Gilda Radner?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, when you're understudying Gilda Radner, were you expected to do her characters if she got sick, or would the sketches change and you would do your own characters?
Oh, no, you fit into the show and you know, I started basically imitating her. So I even got a perm to look like her.
Really?
Yeah.
So what characters was she doing that you had to do?
Actually, I would say maybe in that show it was an early version of her Emily Letella. I think that's the woman that would say, never mind, you know, she'd on the news on Saturday Night Live. Because she was doing an interview, this is one scene I remember, an interview scene with John Candy interviewing, and she was talking about her shoes, being able to talk to her, and she was just sort of this sweet old lady, and you had to believe what she said because she was so convincing. And I would, you know, dare to take her place, and when I did take her place, actually replace her in Chicago, the producer and director at the time, Bernie Solins, I look back on it now, and I realize he must have really missed her, and it was like a man who'd lost his wife and had a new girlfriend and wanted the new girlfriend to be like the wife. Because he just said, no, Gilda did it like this. No, Gilda looked at him like this. No, say it like Gilda. Do it like Gilda. And I was, like, weeping by the end of the day, thinking, I'm not Gilda. What does he want from me? Let me be myself. But I had to. That's the way it is at Second City, because you do fit into a show. You have to start by imitating the person you're, you know, as not to disrupt the show and throw the other people off. You have to fit in as easily as you can, you know, and then you find your way.
Catherine O'Hara speaking with Terry Gross in 1992. We'll hear about her work on SCTV in a moment. Of all the over-the-top showbiz characters SCTV loved to feature, one of the most memorable was this one, created by Catherine O'Hara.
Now join the Sammy Maudlin Show, already in progress.
Woo! Ladies and gentlemen, Lola Henderson! Isn't she something?
Hi. Can you move down, sweetheart, please?
Hello.
There we go, sweetheart, right over here.
Hi, Willie.
Oh,
let me ask you about some of the characters you created for SCTV. Can we start with Lola Heatherton?
Yeah.
She was a real, like, showbiz singer, somewhere between a has-been and a never-was.
Oh, I love playing kind of cocky, untalented people.
Yeah.
It was fun.
So did the Heatherton come from Joey Heatherton?
They'd done Sammy Maudlin's show a few times on the show, and I'd only gone on a couple of times as a character that didn't fit in like this. I did a Trish Nutley thing, which is supposed to be like a starlet, and I went on, and I didn't understand, you know, the game, and they were all real, you know, insincere and show busy, and I didn't fit in. So I didn't have a character that was sort of one of them, you know. And then we did, we were asked to do the Junos or something. No, not the Junos, the Canadian, the Nellies, the Canadian Television Awards. We were asked to do it live, and Joe Flaherty and the others wanted to do a Sammy Maudlin show, and I had to get a character for the show that was like them, right? A sleazy kind of has-been Vegas character. And I think the night before we started writing it, I saw Lola Falana on The Tonight Show, and she was singing Sometimes When We Touch. and she was making her bottom lip quiver, and she was really crinkling up her eyes, trying to get some tears going. So by the end, she was crying. But I thought, well, there's a thing to use. I'll use that. And I'd also just always been fascinated with Joy Heatherton from those Be a Perfect Sleeper, Buy a Perfect Lucerta ads. Mm-hmm. It's the only thing I'd ever seen her in. But I liked her look, and so I went with her blonde hair and her look and the Lola Falana kind of tear thing whenever I could. And otherwise, it wasn't based on anyone. I took their two names, you know, Lola Heatherton.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you used to do Meryl Streep, and this was the period when Streep was famous for developing her characters through accents, in a way.
Yeah.
You had acted in a movie with her in Heartburn in 1986, but...
That was much later, yeah.
Yeah, so you were doing her before you were with her.
But I only did her once, and that was Big Jim and Billy Saul Hurock, or whatever they were called. Joe and John had these kind of country bumpkin characters who had a... showbiz talk show, and then they would bring on guests just to blow them up. And usually it was people they didn't like. You know, they would sort of get people in showbiz by having them on the show and blowing them up. But I think at the time, Meryl Streep had done a lot of movies where she was crying a lot, and they just wanted me to go on and start crying and then blow me up. This is so stupid. I can't explain it. They wrote it. Don't blame me. But that was always the case with any impersonation. I would, you know, I'd write something or somebody else would write something, and then you would just have to get that impersonation. You'd try to get it together as well as you could just for that scene, and then it would be gone. And when I did try to do Meryl Streep in that scene, I had about 5 lines, and maybe 2 of them sounded like her and the other 3 didn't. You know, so she was not somebody I did regularly.
Now, what about Katharine Hepburn, your version of her?
Yeah, that's the same sort of thing where I think the first time I did it, Dave Thomas and Rick Moranis had written a scene for her, and I mean for her to be in, and so then I just went and watched a couple of tapes, and she was supposed to be as herself, you know. So you were really lucky if whoever you were supposed to impersonate had recently done something, you know, for television, or you get a tape of it, you know. And I got a tape of her and Dick Cavett, which was her being herself, and I just sort of watched that a few times, and then I sat in a room by myself and tried to wreck my voice basically, and I just would go until I basically wrecked my voice, and then I would do her. But I only did her a couple of times on the show, and each time I had to, you know, really work on it for, you know, a half hour or whatever beforehand.
Katherine O'Hara speaking with Terry Gross in 1992. She's one of the many gifted comic actors showcased on the new SCTV Volume 2 DVD box set just released by Shout Factory. In the second half of the show, our tribute to SCTV continues with Martin Short and founding member Eugene Levy. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Mark Summers' new illustrated edition of Poems and Tales by Edgar Allan Poe, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the Alzheimer's Association, encouraging Americans to learn about ways to reduce the risk of Alzheimer's disease, on the web at alz.org. And from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Sickened, The True Story of a Lost Childhood, a memoir by Munchausen by Proxy survivor Julie Gregory. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Literally hundreds of comedy movies and TV shows can trace their roots back to Second City TV, a low-budget TV show which got its start in Canada and introduced many of the comic talents who later appeared on Saturday Night Live, including Martin Short. We'll speak with him and with SCTV founding member Eugene Levy coming up on Fresh Air. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. And this is Eugene Levy from Second City TV, playing smarmy showbiz comic Bobby Bittman.
Hochma, hocha, hochma, hocha. Love you with all my heart. Return to me and always be my melody of love, love, love. My melody of love, love me do. You know I love my melody of. Some people think the world has had enough of Polish love songs. My melody of love.
How are you?
That's Eugene Levy as entertainer Bobby Bittman and Joe Flaherty as the host of the Sammy Maudlin Show. In the SCTV universe of cast-offs, has-beens, and never-wers, they were two of the most humorously abrasive and unforgettable. On SCTV, Levy also played network TV newsman Earl Camembert and, with John Candy, one of the polka-playing Schmengi brothers. On film, he's played the dad in the American Pie movies and done everything from acting opposite the Olsen twins in New York Minute to opposite Catherine O'Hara in A Mighty Wind. Terry spoke to Eugene Levy in 1988 when he was starring in a Cinemax comedy special. It was called The Enigma of Bobby Bittman. It was a mock documentary of the performer's career on the occasion of his 1,000,000th performance.
1,000,000 how are yous later, huh? Yeah, it's been a tough road, all right. It's been a tough road. I had to step on a lot of people to get here.
Can you describe the Bobby Bittman character?
I guess he was based on a generic kind of comic that came out of the 60s that I grew up, watching on television, the kind of stand-ups that played Vegas, the Shecky Greens, you know, and the Alan Kings and the Marty Allens and... He's really obnoxious and loud, and it was a kick for, a quiet, shy, kind of likable guy like myself to play.
I love women. You know that? I really do. And if you don't believe me, I can show you some canceled alimony checks, because I got a stack of them. I'll tell you that. Now, I've had so many wedding nights, I could make a week out of them.
Yeah. I love the laugh that you've invented for Bobby Bittman. How did you come up with that, and why did he have to have that kind of laugh?
Well, I think it had something to do with drawing focus to yourself. I think it had something to do with walking into a room and making sure people, saw you coming in, So, I mean, coming in with a line like, "How are you?" your eyes shift and you would look at this fool walking in and for better or worse, you're going to, watch him for a while.
I also love the contrived geniality of that laugh.
Well, everything about the man is contrived.
Right.
I mean, that's the sad, the thing about this particular character. He's really reached new heights of despicability in this thing, and I'm not sure why. I don't know why he's as unlikable as he is.
What was it like for you the first time you saw yourself in the Bobby Bittman toupee with the Bobby Bittman tuxedo type outfit?
I got
and
news
the chains?
For you.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was my own hair when I started doing the show.
Oh, really?
Okay? Yeah, that was not a toupee. That was my own hair. That's the way I used to look. Okay? Now let me, and this is, this is taking, I've grown up a lot in the last few years, so I can say this publicly now. I did look, that was my look. And, Bobby Bittman and Earl Camembert, the only difference between the two characters was one wore glasses. You see? It was the only difference between them, because that's the way, that was my look.
And I should mention for our listeners who aren't familiar with Second City TV, with SCTV, that Earl Camembert is the news anchor that you played on there.
Yes, but I think for people who aren't familiar with the show, this is probably going to be kind of a tedious interview, but I mean, really. But for those people who watched the show and were into the show, I hope I can shed just a little light on some interesting little tidbits of information that you may have been wondering about.
Can you do stand-up comedy after having done Bobby Bittman for so long? I've never seen you do stand-up, and I don't know if you're even interested in doing it, but it seems to me it would be pretty tough to do it.
After doing
Bittman.
I've had no interest in doing stand-up comedy. I think it would just take... I think you don't have to be insane to do stand-up comedy, but you definitely have to have, like, you know, something missing. I couldn't take that kind of rejection. It would devastate me. My reaction wouldn't be, all right, let's just fix the material and come back again tomorrow night. I'd be on a plane out of that town so fast. I like to do my thinking kind of behind a typewriter. I approach my work the way an actor approaches his work, except my work is comedy. So as a comic actor, that's what I am. When I'm introduced as comedian Eugene Levy, there's an expectation that, you know, I can, you know, come out, get behind a microphone and, you know, keep a room, you know, in stitches for 20 minutes. Well, you know, I don't have 20 minutes. It is character work, and that's how I get my laughs through the characters.
Tell me about Sid Dithers and how you created him. How can
I say... He's a guy with bad eyesight, and he's not stands maybe 5'2", and
toughest thing about Sid Dithers, as with a couple of characters, was that for some reason I chose to, you know, cross my eyes slightly behind, you know, inch thick lenses, and it was physically, you know, it was like migraine time every time I did the character, but a great character. We never spoke Yiddish in my family. I did not have a handle on any kind of Yiddish dialect. The first time we did the scene where Sid Dithers was in the scene, Harold Ramis told me that his grandfather had one expression that he used to say all the time, and that was,
"So how did you came? You drove and did you flew?"
And I would take that expression, and I kept saying it over and over and over, and finally it launched, you know, the dialect for me, and it really helped. And of course, you know, Sid manages to squeeze that in.
So you didn't have any Jewish grandparents who took Sid Dithers personally?
No. Nobody took Sid Dithers personally, but, you know, there are millions of Sid Dithers out there, and you usually see them driving, you know, behind the wheel. You see their little head behind the wheel of a giant, you know, Olds 98, and the one thing you don't want to do is be driving behind them.
You know, in reading a little bio about you, I learned that you had performed in, I guess it was a roadshow of Godspell, and I was really trying to picture this, and I can tell you I really still have a hard time imagining you in one of these, you know, rock musicals. It seems to be exactly the kind of thing that you'd parody in something that you were doing yourself.
Well, back then, that was a big show for a lot of us. That was in Toronto. We did the show. We had a great company. Myself, Marty Short, was in that show. Andrea Martin was in that show. Paul Schaefer was the musical director.
God,
on that show.
What a strange
Gilda Radner
show it must have been.
Was in that show.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of great people, and that was really the first big professional job that all of us had done, you know. I mean, that was like a steady gig. That was like a year contract, you know, playing a major theater in the city, you know, at you know, $165 a week. That was like, we thought we'd made it. I mean, we'd actually made it. A steady check coming in for an entire year. And we left that and went right into, you know, Second City, which was a really tough transition, at least for me.
Eugene Levy, speaking to Terry Gross in 1988. It wasn't only Bobby Bittman and Lola Heatherton. SCTV featured many great guest musicians, Levon Helm, Roy Orbison, The Tubes, Al Jarreau, and others. Here's Dr. John, who appeared in their Chinatown spoof, Polynesian Town.
Such a night, such a night, sweet confusion under the moonlight, such a night, it's such a night, got to stay. time seem right. Baby, your eyes met mine. At a glance, you let me know this was my chance. You came here with my best friend Jim. Here I am just trying to steal you away from him. If I don't do it, somebody else will. If I don't do it, somebody else will. If I don't do it, somebody else will. If I don't do it, somebody sure will. And it's such a night.
Dr. John, a guest on SCTV with one of his signature tunes, Such a Night. Coming up, Such a Clown. Terry speaks with one more SCTV veteran, Martin Short. This is Fresh Air. Martin Short joined Second City in 1977. He was one of many Saturday Night Live cast members who got their start in improvised sketch comedy with Second City, but was one of the few to appear on both SCTV and Saturday Night Live. In fact, some of the characters Short made famous on SNL, like Ed Grimley, he first tried out on SCTV. One of Short's Second City characters was a rabbi who posed the question, "Why are Jews funny?" This was recorded at a Second City stage performance in Toronto.
Why are Jews so funny? I believe that there are two major reasons that we will list one and B. A. Comedians are generous people, and the generosity of Jews forever lightening and brightening the messengers of woe. I am reminded of the bum that walked up to the Jew on the street corner and asked him if he could have $5 until payday, at which the Jew asked, "But bum, when is payday?" At which the bum replied, "I don't know. You're the one who's working." I don't know, you're the one who's working. And B, comedians are courageous people. And Julia has always stressed survival and true courage. I am reminded of the blind prostitute. You really had to hand it to her.
Martin Short recorded in the late 70s at a Second City performance in Toronto. On Saturday Night Live, in addition to doing Ed Grimley and Jackie Rogers Jr., Martin Short was also known for his impressions of Katharine Hepburn and Jerry Lewis. More recently, in his own show, Martin embodied the rotund celebrity talk show host Jiminy Glick for Comedy Central. In 1989, Martin Short told Terry that when he was growing up, there was a lot of comedy at home.
Comedy was very normal in our family. Do jokes was to be normal. Insult each other was normal. It was an Irish family that could have bursts of anger and then be gone in 1 second. It's very interesting. I have this like opening of Christmas gifts from 1966, a tape that I put on when I was a kid, and I heard it this year, you know, and I was amazed. It was like a mental family. It was like, screaming and shouting, and then laughing within the next second. No particular rhyme or reason to it. And so comedy was very normal.
Let's talk about Jackie Rogers Jr. A great character.
It's very. Now, let me say something about you. That you like Jackie is very revealing because, you know, there are two camps on Jackie. People either find him totally, I mean, just hate him.
Oh, really?
Or they love him.
Oh, I love him.
Like the cast at SCTV, most of them didn't like Jackie.
Really?
Yeah, they thought it was just kind of grotesque. And we'd write these pieces, we'd take them in the read-through, and they just kind of die, you know? But because the cast trusted me, they let me do it.
Well, I like Jackie because he's so extravagant and so show busy.
Yes, he's also the most self-absorbed character that I've ever done.
He's a lounge singer, for any of our listeners who don't know.
Who's also albino.
Yes.
And cross-eyed.
Mm-hmm.
His long white hair.
I think it's fair to say that one of his anthems is She Loves Me.
Yes, it was his dad's song. You know, she loves me and my amazement. I love her. What the heck does that mean? Nom, 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 nom.
That's a Sheldon Harnick song.
Yeah.
And he also wrote the lyrics for Fiddler on the Roof. And
right.
This is from the show She Loves Me. How did you, I think Jack Jones had the hit of it. How did you choose that song as the perfect showpiece for Jackie Rogers Sr. and Jr.?
I don't know. I used to go into the writer's office at SCTV, and I'd always be like, she loves me under my amazement. And they'd say, you should do a piece on that. And this is 1982. And I kind of said, well, I don't know if this is an old subject matter, you know, lounge singers. But then I thought that I would do a short piece, a two-minute piece, on this character, Jackie Rogers. And if I had him die at the end of the piece, then it would be no problem repeating Turf. So we wrote a piece called Jackie Rogers, Old Mother Nature, She Loves Me, which was supposedly something that had been done in 71, and Jackie Rogers had been killed while doing it. Whilst doing it, as Ed would say. And they were finally releasing it 11 years later.
We talked about some of the characters that you created for a sketch comedy. Let me ask you about one of the impressions that mm-hmm. you did, and that's of Jerry Lewis. I think you're really good at it because you know physical comedy and you can capture the kind of goofy aspects of Jerry Lewis, but you also get the kind of dark side, the bitter side, and the ego of the man. How do you rehearse to do him? What do you steady him before doing him?
I would start singing, gotta get my old tuxedo pressed. Gotta smile, hold notes, and shake. And I tell you what a joy and a thrill and all good stuff. You know, you just kind of... I would suck a lozenge, imaginary lozenge. I don't know why. It's not like he does a lozenge. But it's just an idea of, you know, an attitude. And sometimes you just hear people. It's like music. You know, you hear it and you just kind of get the placement...
Yeah.
In the voice or the throat and nasal, or Robin Williams, very kind of like that, you know, God, that happened, there's more back there, you know, so you just kind of play.
Now, I've read about you that when you were young, you used to do an imaginary TV show in your room that would run on alternate weeks in your imagination with the Andy Williams Show.
Yes, that is very true, and we were canceled too, finally, which is a tragedy. Hullabaloo, I think, replaced us. Yes, I used to, it was 8:30 Mondays in my mind.
Right.
And we'd tape ahead, you know, we'd have shows in the can. And I'd type things up for TV Guide, you know, highlights Marty will sing. And I would come out and I had a Frank Sinatra the Sands album, so I used that as an applause record. And then, you know, I'd use intros from albums, you know, and I'd have a guest, you know, my guest would be Tony Bennett, and Tony would come out and say, forget your troubles, come on, get happy. The Lord is waiting to take your hand. I'd sing another song, I just don't remember the words, you know, and he'd be my guest, and then I would, you know, sing with him, you know, with the record, and then I'd go to the applause, and I'd, you know, piece it together, reel to reel. And then I would take, you know, the Playboy of that month and do the interview with Eldridge Cleaver or something, and, you know, I'd sit and you say that we're not moving fast, and, you know, and I'd then read his part, and then I'd end with a medley, and then someone would call dinner, and we'd tape later.
Did you sit on a stool and sing like Perry and Andy used to?
Oh, sure, yeah. But sometimes I just throw that stool aside and belt out a big final.
Because that's the kind of informal guy you are.
There was no one restraining me.
So, who were your sponsors?
Bulova Watch was a biggie. And the Kraft people.
They did.
No cigarettes even then.
They did pericomo.
Yeah. Correct. Well, I know. They were very generous to help me out as well.
Why, if you were doing an imaginary show, would you have it alternate every other week with Andy Williams? Why not be on every
other
week?
How could I do my films?
Every week, I mean. What?
How could I do my films?
Oh. Yes.
Remember,
yes,
I was directing as well.
No, when you were doing these shows, were they serious in your mind, or were they parodies of the show? I mean, were you doing them for real, or were...
No, it was real. I had a fantasy world that wouldn't quit, you know? I mean, I would... If I got on the back of a bus, I would go... If I got on a bus, I would go to the back of the bus, where the windows were kind of oval-shaped, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that it would... I'd have more of a sense of riding in a limousine. Do you know what I mean? It's like... And if I looked out the window, or I'd pretend I was, you know, on an airplane taxing off, and fans had, you know, this is a 10. I was just intrigued by it. It wasn't something, it wasn't like Rupert Pumpkin, or wasn't it?
Rupert Pumpkin, yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't that sick, you know, it was clearly a fun hobby. You know, it was fun. And while other kids my age were protesting, you go to have a revolution, I was up in my room singing, weather-wise, it's such a cuckoo day, you know. But certainly in no way did it become something that I, you know, would answer to two different names or anything.
Did your imaginary show have a theme? A song?
No, there would be a production number, you know, kind of opening, which would be similar, where dancers come out and go, Marty, it's time for Marty. But I mean, that wasn't a real theme.
Oh, what a nut.
Yeah. Sad, huh?
Martin Short recorded in 1989. We'll hear a more recent conversation with him in a minute after this break. This is Fresh Air. Terry Gross first interviewed Martin Short in 1989. When they spoke again 13 years later, they returned to the topic of his early showbiz fantasies.
So when you were young and you were watching all these TV shows and doing your imaginary show, did you have any training? Did your mother say, send this boy to acting school or give him singing lessons, develop that talent?
No. My mother was the concert mistress of the symphony. She was the first female concertmaster, actually. So I grew up with, at times during the season, 5 hours of practice heard within the house on a violin. So the idea of rehearsal and opening night was not foreign. But no, I think growing up in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, you don't instinctively, Broadway isn't down the street, so it all seems not terribly realistic. So it wasn't until I was in university, and having done theater throughout university, realized that there was actually an acting scene in Toronto, Ontario, which was 40 miles away.
Did your mother measure talent according to more classical standards of rigorous studies and a more legit kind of singing voice than you probably had? You had a more pop voice.
No, you know what? It was very interesting. She was always very encouraging. In fact, when I was 15, Frank Sinatra had released an album called September of My Years. And I re-recorded that. I typed all the lyrics. And I had an attic bedroom, and the hallway to the bedroom was kind of had an echo to it. So I set up my chair. I had a microphone, reel-to-reel. And I would play the introductions from the Sinatra album. But it would be, and of course, Frank was, you know, 53 and I was 14. But the introductions would be in his key, so it would be do 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 do, and here, click. Strangers in the night. Too long. I was in Frank's keys. But I would do the album, and it would take me about a week, you know. I'd make up an album cover, and then my mother, I remember, listened to it and critiqued it because she used to adjudicate at certain, you know, violin contests and things in her life, and so she wrote a synopsis a critique of each song, and this the pitch was very good, lovely old song, well phrased at the end, hold the note too long here. And rated on as 4 stars, 3 stars, 3.5 stars, you know. So I still have that.
Wait, was that helpful?
It was helpful. I think it was mainly helpful because someone was taking my fantasy world very seriously and treating it with credibility and respect. You know, Frank Sinatra once said that his father was always around to piss on his dreams. And I think it's very important for parents to constantly nurture and support eclectic interests of their children, because you never know which one is going to become the fuel that drives their life.
Martin Short speaking with Terry Gross in 2002. His work will be on the next collection of SCTV DVDs, which will be released next year. Dave Thomas, Catherine O'Hara, and Eugene Levy, along with John Candy, Rick Moranis, Joe Flaherty, and Andrea Martin, all appear on the 2 volumes of the classic SCTV series, now available on DVD, from Shout Factory.
I'm Yash Mengi.
And I'm Stan Schmengi. And tonight, the Happy Wanderers salute composer John Williams.
Today's program was produced and directed by Fresh Air's executive producer, Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David B. Incouli.
That, of course, was the main title theme from the movie Superman. Stan?
So, here is the music from the Star Wars.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Alfred A. Knopf, publisher of His Excellency George Washington by Joseph J. Ellis, author of Founding Brothers. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the secret word is peewee. We'll talk to Paul Rubens, the man who created and played children's TV host and big screen hero Pee-wee Herman. 5 seasons of Pee-wee's Playhouse have just been released on DVD. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Uh-huh.